Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tan, and we're going to be talking a lot about Mexico on this programme. Donald Trump, some of his appointments, and two of the world's biggest pop stars, Drake and Kendrick Lamar. But we're going to start the programme in South Asia and the Indian Parliament. You get a sense of some of the chaos that has been taking place there on Wednesday. The parliament has been suspended again after clashes broke out between the BJP and the Congress Party. The opposition party have been demanding answers regarding bribery charges related to the Adani Group that have been filed in the United States. They, of course, have denied all those charges. Let's hear from an academic who knows the company well, Milim Vaishnav. He's also the host of the Grand Damasia podcast.
Gautam Adani is one of the richest men in India, and indeed one of the richest men in all of Asia. He is the CEO of a sprawling conglomerate whose interests range from airports and roads to data centers and green technology. He has seen just a fantastic rise in his own wealth and in his company's growth, which happens to coincide very neatly with the political rise of Narendra Modi, who is now the Prime Minister of India. And so he has seen and often portrayed as a national champion for not just Indian interests, but even arguably Modi's interests.
And it's interesting, they come from a similar part of the world in Western India, don't they?
They come from the state of Gujarat, which is a state that Narendra Modi was the chief executive of for more than a dozen years. And that's really where Mr. Gautam Adani got his start. He was a provincial business person who, thanks to his access to Modi and the powers that be, started to gain favorable concessions and really built up his business first in the state, then nationally, and now internationally. I mean, the Adani Enterprises have become a name all around the world.
We have seen Parliament disrupted since these charges were filed against him and his company in the US. Is that a signal of two things? Number one, his political closeness to the Prime Minister, which you've talked about, but also the fact that he is such a central figure in the Indian economy.
The opposition has been very clear that one of their political strategies is to tie Mr. Modi to Mr. Adani. And to be honest, it hasn't worked very well because there hasn't really been a lot of smoking gun evidence of wrongdoing. Now you have the United States, twin cases brought by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the stock market regulator, and the U.S. Department of Justice, alleging that Adani had masterminded a pretty significant bribery scheme in India. So that has given kind of the opposition new wind in their sails.
In terms of the Adani's international business portfolio, the charges against them in the US, which they've denied, that could cause problems for them. We've seen Total already saying in terms of the relationship, they may not put some money in where they were going to. So it will be a difficult time for the companies.
Adani is now a global company, and it is active in all four corners of the world. And we are seeing in country after country where they're doing business, their partners or partner governments saying that they are going to review these investments and make sure that everything is above board. And maybe the grandest irony is that the U.S. government itself is a partner with Adani to rebuild the port of Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka.
Milim Vaishnav there, and of course the Adani Group has denied all the charges that have been laid against them. Let's bring in Susan Schmidt, Portfolio Manager at Exchange Capital Resources in Chicago. Susan, always a pleasure having you on the program. An important case, and one that could lead to some tensions in trade relations between India and the US.
Absolutely. And as you can imagine, with the change in the presidency coming up, trade relations are the focus for investors right now. This will make a big difference for investors if this continues to be noise in the market. So it's definitely a knock against the Adani Group. Also will impact their ability to access funding and the company's liquidity. Investors are paying attention.
They certainly are, both in the US and, of course, in India. Let us move to Mexico now, because there's been more reaction there to Donald Trump's proposed tariffs on the country. We talked about that, didn't we, on Monday on this program. Marcelo Ebrard is the Mexican economy minister.
Does it impact sobre las empresas.
The impact on business is huge. We more or less think that in the end, these taxes are going to affect the consumer in the United States, but also businesses, and around 400,000 jobs would be lost.
Se perderían alrededor de 400,000 empleos.
Mexico is the United States' biggest trading partner. So how could the country avoid the tariffs that Donald Trump has been talking about? Let's get some answers. But firstly, the impact on the economy from Jorge Castaneda, Mexico's former foreign minister.
Well, I think it can be devastating to Mexico's economy if it takes place. And I think that Mexico is going to have a tough negotiation ahead of it in order to placate Trump's worst instincts. He should be taken seriously. He ran his campaign on the basis mainly of immigration, fentanyl a little bit less, but also. And he loves tariffs, as he says. And so I think this should be taken seriously. And Mexico is going to have to negotiate to avoid this happening, because if it does happen, it could be devastating for the Mexican economy.
Okay, then have to negotiate. You've raised the two issues there, immigration and fentanyl. Which one will be the harder one to negotiate on?
Well, there, it's probably easier to negotiate the immigration issue because Mexico has been doing this the last 8 years, 4 years with Trump and then 4 years with Biden. It hasn't been the same Mexican governments, but many of the issues were that Trump placed on the table on migration, on immigration. Biden did the same. So Mexico is familiar with the issue, is familiar with what the Americans want, and is familiar with what it can do to make the Americans happier on these issues. Basically, deploy more armed forces to chase Cubans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, Haitians away from the U.S. border and preferably not to enter Mexico. It's a very cynical approach, but that's what it is. The drug business is more complicated because fentanyl has a business model which is quite different from other drugs before, from cocaine, heroin, even marijuana back in the 1970s. It's a very different business model. It involves China. It involves the Pacific Ocean and the Mexican Pacific ports. It involves the laboratories, which are very small and mobile and cheap to set up. And it involves enormous amounts of shipments from Mexico to the United States. It's literally thousands and thousands and thousands of shipments every week.
On the other hand, the use of tariffs to try and tackle these problems, what do you make of that? Because when we're talking about fentanyl, there is the supply side. We look at Mexico there. But there is demand in the U.S. as well. There are problems on both sides, aren't there?
Well, yes, of course there's demand, but we know American demand for drugs is not going to go away. Full stop. We've been hearing, we Mexicans have been preaching to them for at least 50 years now that, you know, it's your problem, it's your demand. If there weren't your demand, there wouldn't be our supply, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't you do something to reduce demand? And we know this will never happen. It hasn't happened and it will not happen. We've been going this for five decades now. This is not a new issue at all.
The Mexico economy has grown. The U.S. is its largest trading partner. How crucial a moment is this for the Mexican economy?
Well, the Mexican economy has basically not grown the last 6 years. Per capita growth under López Obrador was negative, partly due to the pandemic, but also to the economic policies he implemented. So the Mexican economy needs to grow again soon. Growth for 2024 is now being forecast at around 1%, a little bit more than 1%. And several different international institutions have now forecast for 2025 growth of at most 1% and perhaps even less than 1%. So the Mexican economy has to grow. And obviously, these tariffs and these threats are very damaging to Mexico's growth prospects, among other reasons, because who wants to invest in Mexico if Trump is going to then slap a tariff on the stuff you were going to ship to the U.S.?
Jorge Castaneda there, Susan Schmidt still with it. And that is an important point, isn't it, in terms of future investment if tariffs are placed on Mexico?
That is a very important point. And relevant because many companies over the last 5 to 10 years trying to get out of Asia have invested in Mexico and do have manufacturing plants there. So U.S. companies have manufacturing bases in Mexico. Those parts and components that are being made in Mexico that they are shipping to their other subsidiaries in the U.S. will now be subject to a tariff as well. So U.S. companies themselves are going to get hurt by this. And at the same time, you have higher cost goods coming in. U.S. companies, to keep their profitability, are going to have to pass that through. And that means a higher priced product to the consumer.
Yep, there is a lot of talk, isn't there, about possible inflation. Who knows what tariffs will actually be put in place on the 20th of January. But Donald Trump is using them for trade, but also political reasons. So are we entering a new phase of trade policy globally? That's a question for Simon Johnson, the Nobel Prize winning economist from MIT.
Yes, it is a new era. I mean, this is the era of Donald Trump, by the way, in case anybody hadn't realized. Tariffs have been used in this way before, including by Mr. Trump in his first administration. He used the threat of tariffs to make Mexico close its southern border with Guatemala, which substantially reduced the flow of immigrants into the United States. The game is definitely on.
Of those countries, do you think it is Mexico that is in the most difficult position?
Yes and no. With Mexico, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Trump wants them to close their southern border again, and that they can do. He'll want them to take some action against the smuggling of fentanyl. And, you know, frankly, the Mexicans don't like fentanyl coming through their country either. So I don't think that's a problem. And he also, I think, this is sort of reading between the lines, but it's fairly clearly written between the lines, doesn't want Chinese companies to move operations from China to Mexico. So Mexican government is already discouraging that kind of trade diversion, as it's called.
The nearshoring you're talking about there with Mexico, that is interesting, isn't it? Because that is a clear message to many countries that at some point now you're going to have to choose under the Trump administration, maybe between China and the US, the world's two great economies here.
Possibly. I mean, I think on the issue of nearshoring, you're right to put your finger on that, because under Trump 1, the previous administration, when NAFTA became USMCA, so NAFTA was renegotiated, it did seem that Mr. Trump and the people around him were okay with more production coming into the United States from countries that were very strong allies of the United States, such as Mexico and Canada. Now it seems that nearshoring may not satisfy the so-called MAGA faction of the Trump administration, and you need to put it somewhere else. But the chances that this output will come back to the United States with a large number of jobs is very low. Much more likely is that production will move from China to places like Vietnam and maybe other low-cost countries. So it's a complicated picture in terms of what Mr. Trump can actually hope to achieve with these tariffs.
It is a complicated picture. And I suppose when we're looking at business and economics, generally, it's a world where people like certainty. Now, the one thing that we can say with the Trump administration is policies can change very quickly, which makes it difficult, doesn't it?
Yes, I think we can accept this is a period of heightened uncertainty from the policy perspective. No question about that whatsoever. It's going to be a big policy shift from Biden to Trump. Mr. Trump himself may be volatile. But I would also layer on top of this that how markets is going to be extremely important. So exchange rate movements, the depreciation of the Mexican peso after the announcement this week, the presumed depreciation or further depreciation of the Chinese renminbi, these are significant factors for businesses. And these also may offset the effect of the tariffs themselves, which complicates the cards that Mr. Trump's holding in his hands.
Let's pick up on one of the points there from Simon. What can we expect from the Trump administration? We've been trying to answer that question over the past few weeks. He has now, of course, filled those key economic positions. Here's Paul Winfrey, president and CEO of the Economic Policy Innovation Center in Washington. And he served in the first Trump administration as the director of budget policy.
In other areas of the government, I think that we see change agents that are likely to shake things up a bit relative to the status quo. For instance, the president's picks at the Defense Department. But by and large, those that he's hiring to oversee the economic policy of the administration, for the most part, in my view, are, you know, pretty standard picks that I think are going to send pretty positive messages to the economy.
So a lot of people see Donald Trump as a disruptor, don't they? Do you think that when it comes to the economy, it will be different?
To a certain extent. At the same time, I think that look at Kevin Hassett, who was just picked – last night to lead the National Economic Council. That's the president's sort of top chief economic advisor within the White House. He was at the Council of Economic Advisors during the last administration and is a pretty standard guy. You know, I wouldn't necessarily call Kevin a disruptor. At the same time, he most certainly is an outside the box thinker. And I think that the most disruptive area that the president is going to engage in is obviously in international policy, and that's in the trade space and the use of tariffs.
An area that I know you looked at during your time within the Trump administration, and before we ask you that question, have you had a call yet? Is there still a possibility of you rejoining, of getting back in?
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. I've talked to the transition, and I'm willing to help out wherever I can, but no, I haven't gotten the call yet.
Okay, well, who knows? Could be coming. Could be coming after Thanksgiving. Donald Trump is looking at government spending. That's an area that you've looked at closely. Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, they want to slash government spending, reduce it by $2 trillion. Is that really feasible?
$2 trillion in cuts over a one-year period, I think, would be incredibly difficult to do. I mean, the government spends about $7 trillion in gross spending, about $5.5 trillion in net spending every year, not including the taxes that it brings in. I do think that cutting spending by $2 trillion over a 10-year period is very doable. The budget's just that big, and there's enough there that you can scale back. But the really hard problem that they're going to run into, that everybody always runs into, is for every government program, for every government regulation, for every government inefficiency, there is a constituency that benefits from it.
I wonder as well, bringing in somebody like Elon Musk, who is an extremely successful businessman, but hasn't really worked in the public sector, is that the right sort of appointment for this sort of role?
I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes you do need outside thinking brought to bear to questions that have been difficult to solve in the past. But at the same time, I don't know that they're going to be able to be successful without having, you know, the insights from people who have been on the inside before and ultimately know how bureaucracies function. The reason why I'm a little bit more optimistic about what they're doing relative to, you know, what others have tried in the past through government commissions and other departments like this is that Musk and Vivek most certainly have a platform. And from that platform, whether it's X or, you know, just anytime these guys talk, people seem to cover it, they're able to get the public fired up about these issues.
Paul Winfried there. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. It's Thanksgiving coming up in the US, so we are looking at one of the busiest nights of the year for airlines. How busy? Well, I've been speaking to David Kinzelman, United's SVP of Airport Operations and Chief Customer Officer with United Airlines. So, is this evening the biggest ever?
It will be the busiest ever for United Airlines. Yeah, we've been preparing for this week all year. Very exciting time, obviously, to connect people with their friends, family, and loved ones all around the world. We've added 400 flights this year to be able to accommodate the increased demand, which we see coming in very strong.
Give me a sense of how much busier it is. Are you expecting it to be 5% busier, 10% busier? And what are you putting that down to?
On average, we'll have 480,000 people a day traveling during the Thanksgiving period. That's about 30,000 more per day than last year. And in particular, the weekend will be the busiest travel days with more than 530,000. And that's up about 11% versus where it was last year. There seems to be a really strong interest in travel this year, which we're excited about.
Is it a difficult day? Chaotic?
It will be busy. But as I said, we're prepared. You know, we've got full staffing across the whole system at airports. We're running a really safe and reliable, efficient operation. And we have special tools in place like Connection Saver. So customers can rest assured that we're looking out for them for their connections. If we can hold a flight and not disrupt the arrival time, then we'll do that. To date, that's saving about 2,000 connecting passengers every day since we launched. We've also got a lot of preparation, as you can imagine, imagine, into preparing for the weather and being ready for that. You know, we're already seeing snow in the Rockies and across the midsection of the country. But as I said, we're prepared for that and ready for whatever Mother Nature may throw at us.
Can I raise what has got a lot of coverage? And this was the Senate committee that looked at you and other airlines and basically said that you're gouging customers. You're charging them too much for services that probably should be free.
What I would say is that, you know, customers tell us that they want a choice in which products and services they purchase. And so by offering options to suit a wide range of budgets and travel needs, United can best serve customers who value the ability to travel on low fare or those who value premium services and everyone in between.
When senators say you're making billions charging junk fees to customers, how do you respond to that? Why do we people have to pay so much for seats, for baggage? Because when they used to be included in the ticket price, they probably paid less, didn't they?
Well, I would say that for some, they are included. It depends on tickets that are purchased, loyalty programs. There are benefits that come with those. And so at United, we offer a full suite of products. So in some cases, they're low fare and customers have told us that they don't need some of the some options. And then there are customers who want it all. And so we price options for everyone.
David Kintelman, the 80 million people traveling on Thanksgiving Day. Susan, are you traveling? And it's a busy period for many companies, isn't it?
It is. And I am traveling. I'm speaking to you from Austin, Texas.
Not where you normally are. Do we know how good a year it might be for some companies this year, Thanksgiving, good or bad?
I think we're seeing a hint of that in investor optimism in anticipation for Black Friday. So the Friday after Thanksgiving in the U.S., known for being black because retailers turn profitable at that point in the year. Investors are expecting that to be a good turnout and to see strong demand in certain verticals from consumers. And then, of course, my own experience will tell you that airports are full and the American consumer wants that service experience, the luxury experience of travel, more so than anything else right now.
Okay, well, enjoy those travels. Now, to a personal feud carried out through music, which has ended up in the courts.
They not like us. They not like us. They not like us.
If you don't know who that is Kendrick Lamar. That's a single that was released earlier this year. It's had millions of downloads. It's known as a diss track. That's where you get annoyed with one of your rivals. The person in question here is Drake. He's now filed two legal actions against Universal Music for failing to prevent the release of that track, which Drake has falsely accused him of being a sex offender. He's also accused the record company alongside Spotify of illegally boosting the song's profile. And that's what we wanted to look at here on World Business Report. So I've been speaking to Anna Erko, music streaming expert and former musical editorial lead at Spotify.
I'm 100% sure that it is mainly about publicity. I mean, obviously, I'm no friend of Drake or Kendrick, but I think publicity is a major part of what's going on. That's for sure.
There is a lot of talk how about some songs they can get promoted on Spotify. Does it work in that way? How does it work in music streaming if you want your song to be noticed more?
You know, any platform, Spotify included, offers artists and labels and distributors a wide range of tools for promoting their content, their music. And some of them are pretty straightforward, like, you know, submit your new track for our editors, like human editors, and they can put it on editorial playlists. But you know, we're in a digital era, and right now there's a lot of other tools available to obviously big labels, artists, and distributors to promote specific releases. So some of the tools, like the new ones, they allow artists or labels promote their releases in algorithmic parts of the app.
Has streaming, and you know this industry very well, changed the way that you promote your music? Is it easier to promote it on streaming than it was before with things like Spotify, a company that you know well?
It is actually a very ambivalent situation at the moment because on one hand, you really have a variety of tools to promote your music. And on the other hand, it is very difficult because, you know, thousands actually hundreds of thousands, I think, tracks are released every day. And it's getting harder and harder to stand out. So, you see, the answer is yes or no at the same time.
These are two huge artists. Is it possible that a record company could use tools to promote one artist on streaming above another? And if they were doing so, how could they do it?
Actually, it is a right of any distributor or label or artist, even, you know, the artists themselves, they can pick a specific release and market as a priority. So this is happening for sure. As I mentioned, there is a variety of tools. Some of them are more like old school, like, you know, submit your music and our editors will listen to your track and potentially they can add it to editorial playlists. Some of them are very popular. So this is, you know, a very powerful tool actually to promote some new track.
The simple fact is here, you know, there are some serious allegations in this case, and we're not going to move into the legal side of it. But on a very basic premise, when an artist says that a company is artificially inflating the popularity of a song, do you think it is possible to do that?
Well, anything that is not organic is by definition artificial. So this is a very tricky question to answer. This is possible, but it is actually the nature of the promotional tools that Spotify offers.
Fascinating to see what happens in that court case. We will, of course, follow it here on the BBC World Service. Let's just return to the top story that one of the stories we've been talking about today. That was Mexico's reaction to those possible Trump tariffs. Well, the Mexican president had a long call with Donald Trump just a short while ago, discussing migration and security as well. We'll be back with Business Matters in a few hours, but that's it from World Business Report.